Support for Father David Abernethy and his ministry at the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri comes entirely from the donations of community members and listeners like you. The creation of future groups and podcast episodes depends on your commitment and generosity. We humbly ask that you consider a monthly gift of $10 to the Pittsburgh Oratory in support of Father David and his work. To make this or any gift, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org, click the Donate button, and write Father David in the notes section. You can also make a recurring or one-time donation directly through Podbean. Your commitment and ministry-sustaining support are greatly appreciated. God bless you, and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writers series. And we're picking up with our reading of the Ascetical Homilies of St. Isaac the Syrian, Homily 75. And we're starting tonight on page 524, the first full paragraph. And he's been spending a lot of time here in this homily, a very lengthy homily, on night vigils and a kind of fasting from sleep. You know, we've talked about certainly fasting from food and the humbling of the mind and the body that takes place through that, how it deepens one's prayer, makes one more receptive to God, more attentive, and a kind of stillness begins to reign both externally and internally. And one develops a hunger, a desire for God in that prayer and fills it in a bodily way. And the same is true with sleep, that there is a kind of humbling of the body that takes place there, but also externally, things begin to slow down. The darkness falls, the surroundings become silent as well, and that prayer can be continued without distraction. They discovered throughout the entire night even. And so they could engage in praying the Psalms or simply praying the Jesus Prayer and engaging in the whole night in prayer without interruption. So much so that they began to love the coming of sundown because they knew that it was going to give them this opportunity to pray without distraction for the entire night or for most of the night. And you know, we talked a little bit about how this is quite foreign to us, that we don't hear vigils spoken of very much in our day. And in fact, our lives are set up as such that it would make it very difficult for a person to have this as a regular part of their life, unless they consciously chose to reorder their life in a certain way to make it possible, in part, you know, weekends or arranging their work schedule in such a way that it would allow it even in great measure. But when you hear someone like Isaac tell us that this is the most powerful form of prayer and stronger than praying at any time during the day, and that it is something, in fact, that the devil envies and seeks to disrupt as much as he can, it should speak to us on some level in terms of what it brings about within the mind and the heart and what it fosters in terms of that desire for God. And so tonight he begins to focus in particular upon examples from the fathers for us to show us what it cultivated within them, first with St. Anthony of the Desert, and then St. Arsenius as well, and how they engaged in it, but also the fruit that it bore within their life. And then he'll sort of round out the chapter talking to us about deciding within ourselves if this is something that we want. After hearing what he lays out for us in the first part of the homily, And then also in the examples of these fathers and what it meant for them. Is this something that you want? Is this what you desire? And if so, is there a willingness within you to endure the afflictions that arise because of it? You know, either the bodily fatigue that it can bring, or the afflictions on a spiritual level, a struggle against despondency or dejection, or with demonic attack on some level, greater temptations, that the warfare becomes more intense. And we don't only see this in the Desert Fathers, I think we see it in somebody like St. John Vianney, the patron saint of parish priest, was known to pray throughout the night. In fact, the people of the town could hear almost like a physical battle taking place between, you know, John Vianney and the demons, that they would often, in a physical way, afflict him. And but we also see the incredible fruit that it had within his life in terms of his holiness, his love for the Holy Eucharist, his love for his people, the confessional, you know, being able to stay within the confessional in a heroic fashion, you know, for hours upon hours. And that despite being, you know, a very simple man, you know, that he was able to convert not only the town of Ars, but also renew in many ways the faith of the people in France. So powerful was his witness. And so again, we do well, I think, to listen closely to this homily. The top of page 524. St. Athanasius, in his history of that example for solitaries, Anthony, says that he kept very long vigils so that he passed the greater part of the night without sleep. And it was, in fact, because of this that Satan found cause to assail this glorious man with his first conflict. And this occurred when the saint was still a young man. We find it frequently recorded in many of the narrations concerning him that he never neglected vigil throughout his whole lifetime, even when he went out to meet others at an appointed time. An example of this is when he went to see the blessed elder Paul, for after they ate the meal brought by a bird that stood in prayer, they stood in prayer all night long. Which of the solitaries, though possessing all of the virtues together, could neglect this work and not be reckoned to be idle without it? So Paul was like the first hermit, and he and Anthony were friends. And we hear mention here of the, you know, bird bringing in food. Last time Isaac speaks to us, you know, how did these individuals, how were they able to sustain themselves in the desert? And if you remember, he talks about sort of miraculous things such as this, animals or an angel or being able to subsist on very little or something as simple as a local townsman bringing food out to them on occasion. But nonetheless, you know, what he's stressing here for us is, you know, the fact that Anthony and those like him saw it of such great value that they practiced it throughout their entire life within the desert. So it wasn't just something they did episodically, that they saw it as so essential to the spiritual life and the growth of holiness that they practiced it daily. And so limited their sleep in a radical fashion and did many different things to keep themselves awake. And, you know, again, this may seem you know, more than extraordinary to us and in some ways impossible for us to even consider this as part of our spiritual life. But I think what St. Isaac invites us to do is to think about it exactly as something that should be a part of our life. And in fact, earlier in the homily, if you remember, he says, you know, I'm speaking to Cenobites, solitaries, and laymen, that this is so valuable that I'm speaking to all Christians here, no matter what your station or state in life. And so, you know, we don't want to immediately move to, you know, our objections that, you know, pop into our mind as to why this would be impossible. For the night vigil is the light of the thinking, and by it the understanding is exalted. The thought is collected, the mind takes flight and gazes at spiritual things, and by prayer is rejuvenated and shines brilliantly. Through vigil there are bestowed on a man the earnest of good things of the life to come, and the graces of those gifts, the mysteries of which are indicated in the Holy Scriptures. Hence our fathers did not neglect this labor from the beginning of their discipleship until they reached the measure of perfection. So it was that even at the time of deep old age, when a man can hardly stand on his feet, they did not allow sloth to prevail against them, and by giving rest to their bodies with a little sleep, to hinder them from the continual vigilance during the night. So, a light to the thinking. And by it, understanding is exalted. And down in the footnote there, this is also the Syriac word for crucified, lifted up on the cross lifted up with on a cross, understood. So, understanding of, I think he's trying to link here for us an understanding of the mystery of the cross, that a discerning mind begins to develop that is able to understand the things of the kingdom, the mysteries of the kingdom, in particular the self-emptying love of Christ on the cross, that all the mysteries that have been revealed to us in Christ begin to take on a kind of clarity, as well as something of the life that is destined for one in the kingdom, that not a monk either in practicing this begins to experience it already in the present or have an insight into what that would be like. And so the eye of the heart, the eye of the soul has been so purified that the virtue is so perfected within them that there's no impediment from the ego or from the passions to prevent them from seeing the things that are divine, the things of the kingdom. And so often you find this in saints, in their spiritual writings, certainly, in describing certain aspects of the faith. But I also think in terms of discernment of what is going on within an individual soul. We find certain saints, in particular confessors, who had the capacity to read another person's soul when they would come to confession. If there were things that they left out or things that were unsaid, that the confessor was able, or if they were too embarrassed to say them, the confessor was able to state them for them. Or Padre Pio, I think, had the capacity to hear confessions during the war, I think, in other languages, that he was able to understand what those coming to him were saying, penitents were saying, but they were able to understand him in return. And so it is this kind of purification that and perfection that exists, but also the grace that begins to flow within them more and more freely, that they develop this capacity to perceive the things of the kingdom. And so he begins to ask these questions. You know, if someone is willing to do this, even into old age when they can barely stand, why is it then that we would not be willing to keep rest from the body for ourselves? Why wouldn't we desire this on some level and long for it? And it's a good question, I think. We've talked many times about how often desire comes up within the writings of the Father and how it is the thing that draws them to God. They begin to long for him and the love and the fullness of the love that he offers. And, you know, is it our own lack of love or our lack of desire that, you know, puts within our heart a kind of sloth that makes us too attentive to the self and the needs of the body and not so attentive to the needs of the soul, to the point that we're willing to do what is necessary to obtain it? So there are definite blessings here to be found within the practice of vigils. Any comments or questions so far on what he has to say? Yes.
So, you know, in some of the Psalms will say, like, on my bed I remember you. I think of you through the night. Or would they be up? Like, would they be up on their knees or sitting or, like, lying on the ground? Mm-hmm. How would it manifest?
Hanging from the ceiling by their hair.
Well, I think they would do whatever was necessary to stay awake. And he addressed this a little bit earlier in the homily, that some would focus on the Psalms and going through each of the Psalms and praying them. If others became fatigued and could no longer stand, they would allow themselves to sit down, but they would continue in prayer. And so for each person, it would vary. And you know, depending upon the strength that they had or the strength that God provided them, they would do whatever was necessary to be able to stay awake and to stay focused on their prayer. And some would, you know, focus on a simpler form of prayer, say something like the Jesus Prayer. If it was too difficult, maybe to focus in an attentive way on the Psalms. And so it could vary from person to person. And those living in community, the Cenobites, often would, you know, some of this vigil would be prayed in common, where they would sing the Psalms and they would do that standing for long hours of the night. I think I mentioned, you know, when I had that opportunity to travel there, one of the blessings that we were able to get up and go to vigils, we were allowed to participate in it, which was generous on their part to allow us to witness it. And it was a powerful experience. And I haven't had another like it, but in, you know, the middle of the night and all the monks there, and, you know, are very kind of a different chanting than we're used to. Very rhythmic, and they would use like little symbols, but also a little triangle to sort of keep the tone. And so very simple, but I think it was meant to help them remain focused. But all the psalms would be sung, and a cantor would lead them in it. And, you know, I saw some movement, like if someone had to get up and get fresh air because it was hot or use the restroom, you know, there was some movement in and out of the room at times. But for the most part, they were focused upon the task at hand. And for, you know, someone who had not ever experienced it, it was vigorous, you know, especially in that heat. And it was odd to see some of them, you know, that have like a shawl over themselves because, you know, it gets cold in the desert at night, like 90 degrees or something like that. So they would pray a large part of that in common. But then certainly, you know, they could go back to their cells and would continue that vigil on through the night or take whatever rest was necessary or perhaps study something along on those lines, where the solitaries would be doing this on their own, like someone like St. Anthony or St. Arsenius, and at times would have to find ways to keep themselves awake. And that's what Ren was talking about, you know, the monk who ties his hair to a chain, so as he nods off, it would wake him up. And so, you know, basically the thought was that it was of such value that whatever means was necessary. Yes?
So, I kind of, like, I'm reading this and I feel like a lot of trepidation because I'm like I'm not even keeping it together where I'm at, and like I'm assuming that when he's talking about the demons like ramping things up and attacking people or like temptations becoming so much worse, all these things, that is still like limited by the will of God for us and like what he desires to allow us to endure for his own purposes. Like, can we be presumptuous in our vigil and then expose ourselves to temptations God doesn't desire us to be be tempted by or afflicted by, because we just like went off and like took another vigil hour. Like it just, it makes me feel really anxious, because I'm like, well, like if things are going to get worse, then maybe I shouldn't take another hour.
Right.
Like
okay.
I signed up to be a sub tonight, now I'm feeling really nervous.
No, that's a good question. And, you know, that we wouldn't be undiscerning and indiscriminate. You know, I think the counsel would be that one would seek guidance from one's elder. And so that one wouldn't just throw oneself into it without being prepared for that. But I think what we see also, you know, in this paragraph and in the paragraphs to come, you know, in terms of questioning, do you desire this? Do you want this? That a lot of the things that we do and the ways that we live our life shows that we do not have that desire, because we fill our lives with distraction. That if we probably, again, you know, stopped for one day and looked at all the ways that we spent time lost in distractions that really did not add anything to our life, but rather detracted from the stillness of mind that we would seek day or night, that we're often engaged in all kinds of things that, you know, pull our minds and our thoughts away from God, that in some way it's elevating the ego, the self, to be the center of one's existence, rather than having God the center of one's existence and our self being focused and finding meaning and purpose in Him. And so I think one would discern with an elder the growing of that desire as well as the capacity by how one is living one's life. You know, over the course of time, is there this movement into deeper prayer simply in one's day-to-day life, in an order that one has already established, the practice of other spiritual disciplines and doing them as well as one possibly can before, you know, taking on vigils. But even having said that, you know, and seeing how they elevated so highly, that one would say, you know, even with those things in mind, would there be a desire to do this? Or are we filled with an anxiety and trepidation? Because we know that within us on some level, the answer might be no. That we might have to struggle with ourself and acknowledge that and even pray to God to give us the desires for the things that would lead us to Him. But I think if any one of us is honest with ourselves, we would have to, excuse me here for a second, we would have to ask, you know, we would have to look and ask ourselves, you know, do I really desire God, you know, in this measure or any reflection of this? Or does my life speak of something quite different? And so I think there would be a lot of signs in a person's life that they are moving in a kind of direction where they're disciplining their will in multiple areas. And they're forming in the mind and in the heart to love stillness, to love silence, to love prayer. That would sort of be indicative then that God would be calling them on to something even greater, which would be, you know, sort of spending parts of the night engaged in this very deep prayer. So a person who has no spiritual life, you know, should not thrust themselves into vigils, because they're going to hurt themselves on some level. And even those who have a spiritual life, there may be many different areas of our life where we're living that half-heartedly, and we're not being attentive to how we're doing it, or we, you know, shortchange God in some way. You know, we rush through our prayers, or, you know, rush through these holy hours, and then we give ourselves over freely to things that are distraction or fill the mind and the imagination with things that are contrary to God's will. So I think, you know, there is a pretty clear understanding within the writings of the fathers that one has to move through dealing with the passions, you know, ordering the desires toward God, deepening one's prayer life, that would give rise then to this greater and greater desire for stillness and silence, where one can encounter God at the depths of one's being. And so, you know, when you mention, you know, kind of fear and trepidation, I think that would be something that one would look at in one's spiritual life. Where is that coming from? You know, is it really the idea of vigils, or is it what that idea provokes within us? And sometimes I think it's going to provoke something pretty powerful, because this is to deny oneself on a very fundamental level of a basic need for sleep. And so when we hear the word vigil, it's going to be a trigger for us, and it's going to trigger a kind of fear, I think, of the idea of living for God completely, of you know, handing over our will to Him fully. And I think most of us would experience, and we probably do, you articulated it, but we probably all do experience this kind of tightening up in fear and trepidation at the idea of doing what we hear one of them doing, you know, especially for an entire lifetime, as it's described here, you know, into their 90s, you know. I can barely walk up a flight of steps, and you think these guys, you know, in their 90s, you know, standing on their feet praying all night.
I guess my follow-up question is just like, so, say you're kind of having a rough go of things in general, but you like feel this desire to have that prayer at night because of the quiet and the stillness that's there and that you know is there, and that it's just like a more peaceful time. Like, if the desire to do that is there, or the instinct that like, I think there's something there that I need, like, should that thought be checked, where it's like, well, why are you really wanting to do vigil if you can't get it together the rest of the time? Or should you say, like, well, maybe something really good will be received at vigil, and so go do that, and then maybe it'll positively affect your day? Like, I guess I'm not sure.
Right, and I can't answer that question either, because psychologically and spiritually, that's a pretty complex question. One can, have this idea of doing vigils and then have the follow-up on it, oh my gosh, that's terrifying. And so then fall back on the thought of what I am capable of doing, but being more comfortable with doing it half-heartedly, you know. And so it can be, I think there's a lot of different things that can be going on within the mind and heart that we would certainly want to unpack and look at honestly. So you're right, you know, I think the thought of vigils could become a distraction, a temptation, rather than a call to deeper intimacy with God. And that's what one would have to discern. I think one can practice it in a certain measure in order to foster that desire. And so like a vigil hour and things like that, all this can give a person a kind of taste for that deep stillness that comes from praying during the night. You know, we might not physically have the capacity to do it all night long, but an hour here and there might foster that desire on a certain level.
So I guess what this initially made me think of is, think it like in addition maybe to desire, is like I read things like, you know, for after they ate the meal brought by a bird, they stood in prayer all night long, you know? And I think it's kind of easy to be like, okay, but these guys are being brought food from a bird, you know, like, this is pretty different. And I think one of the things that can be tough in general, and I think vigil could be definitely one of them, is that, like, on a certain level, you almost have to, like, there has to be a certain level of trust, I think, with God, in a sense, in it. And also an acknowledgement that they weren't brought, like, a 7-course dinner by that bird. You know, like, I don't know what they were about, it doesn't say. Like, it wasn't, you know, and so, like, it's a sustain, and so, like, I think of it as, like, gosh, I, you know, I might have to wake up, and then kids will drive me insane if I take another hour out of the day, and what if I'm grouchy and just all this stuff, and I guess that could be the case sometimes, but, like, you know, you don't, I guess you have to almost, like, trust, though, at the same time that God will help you through it. And also, like, I guess the other analogy that I was thinking about as I was reading this is that, and listening to the comments, is that it's almost also like swimming, you know? Like, if you're a kid, well, sometimes they just teach kids to throw, but pick them up and toss them in the deep end, and they, like, half drown, and then they fish them out. But which I'm not sure that's the best way, in my opinion, but you know... But, like, there is almost a, you know, if you can, like, envision yourself, it's almost like, you know, you're going to get egged on to not do something, to, like, you can't do that. You can't do that. There's a million reasons not to film them. And, I mean, I find it harder that I tend to listen to the million reasons I'm not to do something more than I listen to the whole, like, what, you know, what good comes from it. And that's why I think this is a very, you know, like, powerful homily and witness to the whole aspect of it. And he doesn't just paint as like, you wimp, suck it up and do it. He talks about it as like, look at all the good that's coming from it, the past like Luke's have been reading it. And yeah, I don't know, that's the thing that stood out to me. Like, again, a bird bringing them food. I mean, it's like they trusted God enough to go into the desert, and they didn't really know how that was going to play out. I mean, like, that's how this guy was sustained. And I guess you could go into the desert and just be foolhardy about it too, though. And, you know, like, you could just rush off into the desert and there is no bird bringing food. But, and I guess that's where the discernment comes. But there's also got to be, like, some aspect of being willing to rush into the desert. And, you know?
Yeah. Right. And, you know, I don't want to get into a place here where I'm talking about things that I don't know anything about. And so I do want to let Isaac sort of draw us through this, because I think he does address some of these questions in terms of God understanding our needs and either our limitations of our strength and what needs to be provided. And so that it's not something that should fill us with anxiety, that Isaac does get around to addressing this very question, that, you know, God has the capacity to see, you know, what desire we have within us, but also what, you know, inner metal, you know, we are made of, you know, if you will. And so he will address this. You know, the question about, you know, the bird bringing them food, you know, I think it's, you know, certainly this idea of trusting in the providence of God, but I think it also speaks to their level of discipline. They probably ate like birds, these two guys. I mean, they had discipline themselves to such an extent through their fasting that it didn't take much to sustain them. And so, you know, there are a lot of different ways that we could read this, but let's let Isaac, I think, take us from this point. And they're all great comments and questions, but I think I'd like to let him do it here. And next through Arsenius. That's where we left off, correct? This we also learn from the narrations which are told concerning that perfect image of virtue and of all spiritual accomplishments. I mean the blessed Arsenius. When that celebrated man of Skete had totally withdrawn himself from all intercourse with men and had removed his dwelling far into the desert, distant even from the brethren, he gave himself completely over to the wondrous practice of vigil. His standing during his vigil differed even from that of all the fathers of his time, and his history bears witness to this. On the eve, it is said, of the Lord's day, he would leave the sun behind his back and stretch out his hands toward heaven until the sun rose and shone on his face. And again, in another place, it is said that he would pass the whole night in vigil. And when on account of nature he wished for the approach of morning so that he might have a little rest, he would struggle with sleep and say, "Be gone from me, wicked handmaid." This was when he was quite aged, when it was said that he stooped from old age. And so, you know, we see this kind of variance within the practice of the fathers, and we see a kind of perfection of it that Isaac puts forward to us, before us in Arsenius, that here was a man who had practiced it with his brethren, and practiced it probably within the skeet, you know, which is a smaller group of men living together, you know, a life of deep prayer and stillness. And so he was practiced in that way of engaging in vigils, and then removes himself further into greater solitude and takes on a more unique practice of vigil guided by the Spirit, which was to extend this to the entire night. And already reaching a certain age and perfection at that point, and then, you know, practicing all the way until he was stooped over from old age. So I think what Isaac is telling us here is that there is, like with any other virtue or any other spiritual practice, a movement to the perfection of it. And Arsenius had moved to perfection in virtue and living in the skeet, and then could move out into the greater solitude and the stillness of the deeper desert, and then so engage in a fuller practice of the vigil, which extended throughout the entire night. So again, we come back to this point that there are many and varied ways of practicing vigils, and a different way within the communities and a different way for one living in solitude. And certainly for those living in the world, it would take on a different shape and form too. Again, giving one state in life, age, virtue, how long they've been engaged in the practice of vigil, all these things would have an impact, I think, on how it's practiced. So, you know, I think his thought is to spur us on, not to terrify us with these images, but to hold them out for us as saying, this is something that produces a unique fruit within the soul. But so that his fortitude and vigil be better known, let us hear another tale concerning him, how he undauntedly withstood all his deep old age and weakness, being a man of 90 years. Once he called his two disciples, who were themselves great fathers, and he said to them, "Because the demons are striving with me, and I do not know but that they rob me by sleep, labor here with me this night in your vigils, and watch me and see if I fall asleep during my vigil." So they sat down, one at his right hand and one at his left, from the evening even until the morning. And they said, "We slept and we awoke, and we did not observe that he slept at all. And when it began to be light, there came to us three times the sound of breathing in his nostrils. But whether he did this purposely so that we might think he slept, or whether slumber had really fallen upon him, we know not. And he stood up and said to us, 'Have I been asleep?' And we answered and said to him, 'We did not know, Father, for we ourselves were asleep.'" So they weren't very good watchmen on his behalf. But, you know, it's sort of a funny story, but I think it brings into focus that, you know, part of the struggle is going to be with our natural limitations and weakness. That here they were all seasoned fathers, even the two watching over him. And the two watching over him fall asleep during the night. And then, you know, they can't discern. He's breathing heavy. You know, is he asleep, or, you know, is he just in deep meditation? Or is he trying to confuse us, you know, to make us think that he's sleeping? And so, you know, there isn't, you know, I think we're meant to see the humor in this, that, you know, that we're going to see and experience our weakness, in trying to practice this. I mean, there have been multiple times where in the chapel where I've had my head in my lap because I've fallen asleep at prayer, and or I've had somebody actually shake me on the shoulder and say, "Father, you're snoring," you know, because it must have been so loud that I was creating a disturbance. Now, of course, that was before I started using the CPAP, but evidently it was pretty loud. And there's something humbling about that when, you know, in that desire, you want to be praying, and yet you have, there is this acknowledgement that it's only by the grace of God, and also in accord with the measure of one's desire that one enters into this, that we're struggling not only against the limitations of our physical abilities, but we're also struggling against the, you know, demons and evil ones who seek to disrupt these practices for us. And so we can only enter into this with a kind of humility. And here we're given this story that's sort of funny about these guys who are the holiest of the holy, and it almost becomes like a comic routine that, you know, they both fall asleep and he's sort of snoring through his nose and, you know, wondering, you know, if he's actually falling asleep or if he's staying awake. And it's interesting because sometimes when one is in sort of this deep stillness, it can be hard at times when one is praying to tell if one is simply immersed in that stillness or if one has dropped off. That it can be sort of difficult to discern that. And so I understand what he's saying here, because that inner peace can become so great that one can wonder, oh, did I drift off there? Because time can pass quickly. And sometimes that happens when we have like one of those mini naps, or sometimes it happens when one is deeply immersed in, you know, in contemplative prayer, where time passes very quickly. And I think he's also telling us something here too important about prayer, that, you know, sometimes we are not going to be able to define prayer neatly and cleanly. You know, that sometimes when we think that we're praying, we're really not praying. And sometimes when we don't know if what we're doing is prayer, is really in reality prayer. You know, that we're, you know, struggling, reaching out to God, or we're in this sort of state where, you know, there is this inner longing, but we can't tell if there's any purpose or value to that, because we're so focused on a kind of utilitarian approach to things. You know, what purpose does this serve? What value, what is it accomplishing? Whereas as prayer, there is sort of a setting aside of the self and this focus of one's attention, love, and devotion toward God, abandoning of the self to God, where even the sort of self drifts out of focus. And so one can be engaged in prayer where it can really feel like either one is asleep or one has fallen, you know, into a state of like psychosis. Like the line between extreme holiness, where one is drawn into the reality of the kingdom, is going to be so unlike what we perceive through the senses or what we understand with the intellect, that it is going to be hard to understand and grasp. And we've talked about this before. This is why so many of the great spiritual writers, when they come to talk about contemplation, that they lose the ability to describe it. They don't have the words for it. And, you know, I think Isaac has sort of reached that point here, but he's giving us an illustrative example here, that here are three elders that don't have a clue as to whether or not they're actually praying at that point, you know. And so the thing that becomes important then for us is the desire for God that drives it, that we see in them, that their life was really set upon God and revolved around God, and even in the face of their own weakness and poverty. Okay. Where did I leave off here? Oh, we did not know, Father. In the sweet labors of vigil, the leaders of our way of life took their delight. And what was the sweetness that the heroic Arsenius received from the hardship wherewith he so greatly tormented his body? For it is clear that he did not endure all these things to no purpose. We see that not only was his inner man enlightened by a radiance from on high, so that he rejoiced, but also his outward man, the nature which is corruptible and dense, was clad with the glory in which all the saints will be arrayed at the end of the world, because of the transfiguration that the whole inner nature of man undergoes. So there was this fruit that began to manifest itself in Arsenius, that, you know, that a kind of transfiguration that one would see in Christ on the Mount, already in one's body, that one would begin to see in these saints something of divine brilliance. And he even uses the word, because of the transfiguration of the whole inner nature that a man undergoes, that begins to manifest itself in an external fashion. And it might not be that Arsenius ever even perceived that within himself. You know, it can be the will of God that one would not even see that for the sake of maintaining humility, you know, what is most important. But those around the saint can see this kind of transfiguration begin to take place as there's this growth in holiness. And so, but the main point here is that there is a definite fruit that comes of this labor, and it's a manifestation of the divine in the present and in the person, a transformation, a transfiguration of the self on multiple levels, a taste of the resurrected life and the resurrected body. From whence do we learn this? Once one of the brethren went to the cell of Abbot Arsenius, and he took and he looked through the window and saw the elder standing, and his whole body was like a burning fire. From that, the brother who had gone to see the elder was worthy of this vision, since he was not one of the lesser brethren, but one of the great ones. Because the blessed Arsenius was famous for the loftiness of his discipline, all the fathers desired to see him, but especially because they very rarely saw him, even as Abba Macarius said to him, "Why do you flee from us?" Therefore, the strangers also who came to Skeet to chiefly desired to see him and to receive his blessing. Now, when that brother, to resume the narration, knocked at his door, the elder came out to him, and seeing that the brother was marveling at something which he had seen, he said to him, "Have you been knocking a long time? Peradventure, you have seen something?" And he said to him, "No." So he dismissed him. Smart answer. I didn't see anything. I wasn't spying on you. And so, you know, there was a kind of wisdom even in this elder who witnesses it, that we've often talked about Philip saying, "Secretum meum mihi," you know, when asked about mystical experiences or what went on in the catacombs, all these things, "My secret is my own." And this elder who came and witnessed this, you know, Arsenius being like a burning fire, is marveling at it, but does not talk about it or even tell Arsenius that he saw it, that he realizes that there's something of an intimacy between the soul and God at play there, that he came upon and saw, but is not to impose himself upon it or enter into it, that there would be an inappropriateness to then to want to sit down and tell, "What were you experiencing there? What was going on there with you?" That there would be just something wrong about it. And what shall I say of the blessed Pachomius? For this man was the equal of Arsenius and a leader among the rest, distinguished in struggles, heroic in the wakefulness of vigil. He spent much time in striving with the demons like an illustrious athlete after the manner of St. Anthony. And because many demons came against him during the night, that is when he kept vigil, he besought God to remove sleep from him both by day and by night, so that he might not sleep at all, and he might be able to bring low the power of the enemy, even as it is written, I shall not turn back until they fail, for they are powerless against the faith which is in the Lord. Now this gift was given unto him, even as he had asked, for a certain time. And because he was pure of heart, for the vision of his soul was purified by night vigil, stillness, and prayer, he saw God, who is invisible, as it were, in a mirror. These are the fruits of vigil. These are the blessings of those who labor at it, and these are the crowns of its struggle. So Pachomius is embattled. He's engaged in this warfare. The demons are afflicting him in great measure. And instead of fleeing from this, he asks God for the greater grace to engage in the battle more fully. So he asks for what in our minds seems like an extraordinary grace, that I might not need to sleep, that I might be engaged, stay awake day and night, not to give myself over to worldly things or worldly pursuits, but that I might engage in this battle against the evil one fully, in an unrelenting way. They're at me constantly. Give me the strength then to do battle. And we're told that he's given it for a certain period of time, that he can engage in that battle for a certain measure of time until the demons relent, that they realize, you know, as Climacus describes the individual as a plucky fighter here. This is one who's even willing to ask God not to have to sleep at all so that he could fight all night long as well as all day long. And so he's given it for a certain period of time. And I've often been curious about that, that we hear in the lives of the saints, certain saints being given gifts for like 7 years long, you know, subsisting on a potato a day or on the Holy Eucharist, and or enduring all these things, even the stigmata, you know, sometimes all of their life, sometimes for, you know, a certain amount of time. And it's always in accord with the wisdom of God, what is needed at that moment. And so it pulls it out of our hands as, you know, our sort of seeking for these gifts as an end in themselves. We see in Pachomius this desire to fight the good fight of faith, that he wants to be faithful to God, that he wants to overcome the enemy. And so he asks God for this gift, not to, you know, bolster his ego, his pride, but rather, you know, in order that he might please God all the more fully. And then if God chooses to take it away, then God takes it away. And again, that brings us back to what's important. The desire to please God is what motivates this. And we hear it in St. Theophan, too, as we've been reading. You know, the desire to please God as being the thing that's sort of driving us in the disciplines that we take up on a daily basis. And if, my brother, you also wish to be a partaker of these saints and an heir to their way of life, without despondency, hold fast to stillness so that you may also persevere in unremitting prayer. Endure its afflictions that you may keep possession of its blessings. So interesting, you know, if you want to be a partaker in this and an heir to their way of life, and not fall into a kind of despondency, then you have to hold fast into what precedes it, stillness. You have to foster a kind of stillness in your life that allows a deep prayer to emerge for this constant focus upon God. You know, if you're constantly giving yourself over to distraction, on some level you're showing that this is not really what you want and not what you really desire. And so if you truly desire, preserve that stillness and also be willing to endure the afflictions that come from persevering in that stillness. And there are afflictions. It's fair, I think, to describe them in that fashion, to remain in that stillness and not let ourselves be pulled out of it or drawn out of it for, you know, any particular reason. Becomes, you know, very important that we are able to sustain ourselves in what God has called us to do at any given moment. So you see how Isaac is setting it up there for us. You know, again, all these different examples, all these different manifestations of vigils, all in accord with what the individual's need is and in accord with the will of God and in accord with the person's particular strength. But always, again, coming back to the question of desire. And if your body, for various reasons, should become weary and desist from its labor, and you should not be able to accomplish the works of stillness as usual, and if thereafter your conscience should begin to condemn you, and you should grow despondent and dejected, for indeed it is a work of the conscience unceasingly to reprehend and trenchantly to reprove us, especially if our intention is good, do not say, woe to me, for I am idle. It would be better for me to be outside my cell and do any virtuous work whatever, rather than to have this vain reputation of being a hesychast and a recluse, being idle as I am in its liturgy, that is to be a solitary and all alone, yet far from the duties proper to stillness. Do not say this, for our sweet God bears the burden of our weakness. He only asks of a man that which he has, and he knows better than we what our strength is. So, one of the most important paragraphs, I think, in the homily, that, you know, that there are going to be, that it is a struggle. And we have to be prepared if we acknowledge our incapacity for it at a given time, and we find ourselves falling away from it again and again. Even those who are particularly given over to it here, this Isaac is speaking to, but I think it speaks to us even more, that we're not to allow ourselves to fall into a kind of despondency and dejection, that God sees the weakness and he bears the burden of our weakness. And he only asks that which he has, what we have, and knows better than we do what our strength is. And so if we're failing, you know, God sees it, he bears that, we shouldn't become anxious about it, that he'll give us what we need when we give it. You know, ours might simply be to struggle, maybe it's for years on end, and we bear with that weakness, but always with a kind of trust in God, that he takes that upon himself. You know, and we should not allow ourselves fall into a sadness over this. When your strength is sufficient, toil. And even if you're not able to do anything at all, be joyful, accepting the idleness of stillness, and be patient. But know that if you go out from stillness, not even this thought, which stirs up your conscience to smite you for your idleness, will remain with you. On the contrary, many accidents will befall you on account of the distraction and the laxity of your senses, and they will corrupt even those virtuous deeds you performed previously, because the grace of stillness has been taken from you, and you will fall into temptations and encounter many accidents against your will. So, you know, even if we find ourselves completely incapable of doing it and feeling like it's idleness, that we should not give up on the practice of it. And, you know, and for us, again, this is in a different measure than what the monks were pursuing, but in our own spiritual disciplines, when we feel ourselves completely incapable of the task, we should not give up on it, because then what we will experience is ourselves falling victim then to all the temptations that we set out to leave, and that we set out in faith to leave. And so we don't want to give up on it in that sense, because we would be giving up on God and our trust in Him by not being patient. But though you fall into temptations, do not despair, for there is no merchant who journeys on seas and highways and does not suffer losses. And there is no husbandman who merely reaps his harvest. And there is no athlete who does not suffer blows and buffeting, even though he should take the victory in the end. So it is also with the things of God, with the affairs of the merchants who travel this invisible path. For herein there are both profits and losses, wounds and triumph. Even if you are smitten, do not turn back. Forgive me. The little forgive me at the end is sort of interesting. I think it's maybe wondering, forgive me if I've been too harsh in the saying of this. That, even if you should, be struck down multiple times, be aware of the fact that there's no one in worldly pursuits who does not experience that. And in the spiritual life, it's similar, that if we're engaged in the battle or if we're pursuing the fruits of the kingdom, there are going to be triumphs, but there are also going to be losses, that we're going to bear the scars and the wounds of that battle. And we should not let it make us give up, but rather, persevere in it. And so again, I think we are, brought to an important conclusion here of this homily. He spends all this time holding out to us the beauty, the value, the importance of this particular practice, that it's important and greater than any of the other spiritual practices. But even while doing that, he swings back around to make sure that we don't become discouraged, that as great as it is, that it's no light thing to pursue it. And pursue it we must, with patience and fortitude and perseverance, and even when we fail completely at it. But this is something we should expect, and so not to lose your joy. And so in that sense, simply being on the path and knowing these things and pursuing them should produce within us a kind of joy of the kingdom. And we don't want to allow that to be stolen from us, even while we experience our deep poverty. Any thoughts about the whole homily or these last couple of paragraphs?
The last four paragraphs are my favorite.
See, don't listen to me. We should just sit and...
I love this part because it gets me all the time. Woe to me, for I am idle. That's so amazing. I just want to say that all the time. Woe to me, for I am idle. That's amazing.
It's funny how often, I love this group, and I always have, and the comments and the discussions, because it makes it flow and it draws us deeper. It allows us to listen to what Isaac is saying. And oftentimes the questions and the comments that people, ask or what they say illuminate something. They bring to light something for everybody else that perhaps we haven't thought of. But there is a point where you have to stop and say, let's listen to Isaac, because we don't know the truth of it. It's not our experience. And so I think tonight that sort of became obvious. It's like, I can't answer that question for you. We have to wait and let Isaac spell it out for us with a greater clarity. And boy, did he ever. I mean, you know, he's able within a few paragraphs to console a frustrated soul, you know, that knows its own poverty in a very deep way, and yet continue to draw them on. You know, it's beyond brilliant. I mean, it's only something that holiness could produce to be able to do that. You know, in a few paragraphs.
This is really just a point of curiosity, but do you have a sense of like how often they did all night vigil? And, like, did they sleep afterwards? Like, was the main thing to be up during the night because there's a potency to prayer in the night? And then once the sun came up, they would go to the cave and like get some sleep.
Right.
Like, I just can't.
I think what is described here with Pacomius and Arsenius is the unusual, you know, in terms of the extent of that perfection. I think most would do what you said, you know, that there would be hours during the day where they could rest or they could sleep, you know, and whatever their particular need might be. And, you know, even the Carthusians, you know, you know, they break the night, but they don't necessarily go back to bed, but there are times during the day where they could take a nap to sort of restore themselves if necessary. And, you know, most abbots of monasteries are very cognizant of the needs of their men and so aren't slave drivers, you know. And in fact, the best ones that I've seen often will ask, you know, does anybody need to be excused from vigil or something, especially if as a group they've been working, you know, at physical labor or doing something very difficult that would push them over the edge. So, you know, the wise abbot would be very much aware of his men and what they might need, you know, on not only spiritual level but physically. And so there wasn't this indiscriminate practice of it. You know, I think you have somebody like Arsenius and you have somebody like Pacomius because it's practiced over a long period of time and they were given particular graces and they stand for us, you know, as those who spur us on, you know, that we see something of the kingdom in them and learn then through them to desire for ourselves. But we're not meant to thrust ourselves into despondency by throwing ourselves into something that we're not ready to do. Any other thoughts? So one of the most beautiful homilies, I think, not, you know, because of the content, but because of, you know, how he engages the reader. Just extraordinary. Okay, so we'll pick up next time with homily 76. No, we have two homilies left. The next one is about love and love towards others in their need. You know, what did that look like for even the solitaries who were completely given over to solitude and the focus on prayer? That love, Isaac will tell us, trumps even that solitude when there's a particular need. If someone falls sick, that, you know, our love for the other is something that's more of a reflection of the kingdom. And then in the final homily, the focus is on humility. It's where we're going to end up. And so two beautiful homilies to conclude. Okay?
Having the stories of the fathers as you were reading them, I was thinking how great the Evergetinus is going to be because it's going to be like
a lot. There'll be a lot of that.
It's going to be so much fun. It's going to be awesome.
In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace. Thanks be to God. Thank you all very much.